Welcome back to the Thermo Diet Podcast. I'm your host, Jayden Miller, and today I'm here with none other than Tyler Woodward. How you doing?
I'm great, Jayden. Today's episode is brought to you by Zoom Pre-Workout, best pre-workout on the market.
So today we're going to be talking about pro-metabolic bodybuilding. So do you kind of want to give them like an overview of kind of like the foundational principles of bodybuilding in general?
Yeah, so when starting bodybuilding, it's all about managing stress. So at the end of the day, bodybuilding, like most things, is a stress, but it's an intentional one. It's one that we want to put on the body, and it's one that we have to progressively increase in order to continually make gains over time, get stronger, bigger, faster, and all that stuff. The biggest part of bodybuilding, though, is actually recovery, and it's managing how much stress you're putting on, because it's the game is reducing as little stress as possible on the body in order to continually make gains over time.
Mm-hmm. Why would somebody be doing bodybuilding in the first place?
So generally, having more muscle mass is probably one of the best things you can do for a health perspective, because it's going to release high testosterone levels, you're going to burn fat better, and you're going to be able to burn more fat and generally burn more calories, higher metabolic rate on a daily basis.
What about from like an ideology standpoint? Like, why would somebody do bodybuilding?
A lot of people want to look better, be more confident, and just feel more confident in their own skin.
Mm-hmm. And so as far as like bodybuilding principles, usually one of the things that they're looking at is symmetry, right?
Correct.
Okay. What kind of symmetry are we looking at?
Well, there's symmetry side to side, and there's also symmetry like lower body versus upper body. Mm-hmm. So it's just a matter of taking a balanced approach to bodybuilding and obviously not going overboard on one muscle and lacking on another.
Mm-hmm. What are some muscles that are usually the like most lagging body parts?
So a lot of people neglect calves. That's a big one. But more importantly, I would say is the tibialis anterior muscle. So that's the shin muscle in front of the calves. And that's risen a lot in popularity. But people are becoming more aware of it because it's related to knee pain and absorbing force. But it's also going to make your calves look bigger and your lower legs look bigger.
Mm-hmm. What about for the upper body?
For the upper body, I think forearms, the brachialis, and probably a lot of middle rear delts tend to get neglected. People tend to either neglect lats or rear delts because they tend to be more lat or rear delt dominant, to say. So they do a lot of exercises using their lats or the rear delts, one or the other.
Mm-hmm. Just like before we get into like the nutrition and stuff like that, what are some just like basic ways that somebody could incorporate like exercises to get those in without having to like, you know, extend their workout by another 20 minutes?
Yeah, so if it's an exercise or a muscle group that you're not really focusing on, you can always throw it in between sets. So doing some dumbbell wrist curls with like a 15 or 20 pound weight will be pretty good, and you do wrist extensions as well. Oh, as far as calves, just doing those at the beginning of the end of the workout, those are a great warm-up to get some blood flow into the body. So instead of maybe walking in the treadmill for 5 minutes, you can just go start your workout with calves.
Mm-hmm. Now, if you're going to be doing those in between sets, do you usually recommend like, you know, if you're doing squats to do forearm curls versus like if you're going to be doing lat pull downs?
Yes, that's a great point. So I wouldn't want to do anything where the forearms are going to take away from the main lift. Mm-hmm. So squat, obviously you're not really relying on your grip as much versus a lat pull down. It's very grip dominant or taxing. So that would make a lot of sense to do opposite muscle groups, so to speak.
Okay. Sounds good. So like if you were doing calves, you wouldn't want to do those in between sets of like squats or split squats or something like that.
Yeah, that's not a huge deal because the calves aren't, they're going to be a stabilizer muscle. So it could affect it a little bit, but you wouldn't want to do like hamstrings and calves because that would help to make it harder to stabilize the knee joint. Mm-hmm. But squats you could probably get away with.
Okay. What is the top exercise that you would do for calves and then the top exercise that you would do for forearms?
So if I was only going to do one exercise, it would probably be some sort of straight leg calf raise, but I would want my hips to be like locked into place. So I wouldn't want to do a standing calf machine. I'd probably do a leg press where your upper body is taken out of the equation.
Okay.
And then for forearms, I would probably do a cable wrist curl and cable wrist extension.
Okay. And like the reason that you want your upper body taken out of the equation is from like a stability standpoint?
Both a stability, but then it just gets more complicated. There's more things that can go wrong. You can end up like using your back and stuff. Typically, the more things you can take out of the equation, the easier the exercise is, the more tension you're ensuring or being placed in the calves, mm-hmm. not anywhere else.
So what is your argument between isolating a muscle versus like a compound movement?
So at the end of the day, what grows in a lift is going to be the muscle that's most quote unquote isolated, let's say. Mm-hmm. So the limiting factor. So some people tend to, let's say, take the bench press. Some people are very chest dominant in their best bench press. Some people are really delt dominant in their bench press. Whatever is their limiting factor is going to be what mainly grows from that exercise. A lot of times you can get away with doing compound lifts as you're a beginner and as you progress even into intermediate and even into advanced, depending on the person. But a lot of people will struggle because they're wondering why their delts are lagging because they're doing everything with their chest, or vice versa. They're doing everything with their delts and their chest is lagging. So I'm a huge proponent of isolating muscle because you're going to ensure that it is the limiting factor in the exercise and nothing else is taking away from it.
Okay. So the limiting factor is kind of like the weakest link of the exercise?
Exactly. So okay. What is failing first?
Mm-hmm. And then so you want the limiting factor to be the muscle that you're actually trying to target.
Yeah, so you wouldn't want the limiting factor. Like, so if you're, one thing is I always recommend using straps if you're going to do a deadlift or remaining deadlift. Mm-hmm. If you're going for hamstrings or glutes, right? If you're going for grip, there's probably better exercises to be doing for grip. But if your grip is failing on the deadlift, then your limiting factor is now your grip, your forearm muscles, not your hamstrings. Your hamstrings still have more give.
Mm-hmm. So in that case, you would use like straps to prevent that from happening.
Exactly.
Okay. Sounds good. So you're just trying to figure out a way to where you can optimize the isolation and target the limiting factor?
So exactly. So you want to, in every exercise, you generally want to have one muscle that you're going for. So in bicep curl, obviously you want it to be the bicep. In a hamstring or Romanian deadlift, it could be the hamstrings or the glutes, depending on how you do it. And whatever, you want that muscle to fail first in the exercise. You don't want anything else to be taken away from that muscle to contribute to the exercise.
Mm-hmm. So when would you incorporate compound movements then?
I generally don't incorporate a lot of compound movements, but if you're someone that wants to get good at doing the compound movements, so for example, a power lifter or an Olympic lifter, then you have to be doing it because it's a skill. So the issue with compound movements versus isolation is that you have to teach your body how to coordinate all these muscle groups together and in one fashion versus if you just set up in an isolation movement, your body is not going to use the triceps to do bicep curl, right? Mm-hmm. There's only one answer. But there can be multiple answers depending on your setup, your structure, your form in a compound exercise. So it tends to be a lot more complicated versus I can set you up in, let's say I was like the example, the hack squat. I'd put you at the bottom. You can't really mess it up. It's really hard because you're so stable. You're so locked in. As long as it's set up properly, the isolation exercise is pretty much always going to win from a muscle building perspective.
Mm-hmm. So what about an athleticism standpoint? When would you incorporate isolation versus compound movements?
So again, I think the gym is mainly for training qualities. So you want to get stronger, bigger, produce more power, produce more force. So generally, I still think isolation exercises win. But when you're trying to improve the coordination of an exercise, so trying to coordinate multiple muscle groups and learning that skill, I would generally say that you're probably better off doing that out in the field, right? Doing the drills, the linemen, pushing the pad. But there are some cases where doing explosive work like a kettlebell snatch, something that's less complicated than the Olympic lifts, that's more power driven, can have time and place. And there's also the aspect of the grandma who just wants to walk around and walk up the stairs could probably really benefit from a goblet squat where she has to stabilize herself versus the hack squat because she needs to learn how to use those own stabilizer muscles.
Mm-hmm.
For hypertrophy, that's not going to be the best bang for your buck. But the grandma doesn't really care about building big quads.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So as far as like what is bodybuilding, it's just optimizing the muscle growth of specific muscles to create symmetry of the entire body?
Yeah, I would say so.
Okay. So what are some like nutritional factors that play into that?
So first thing first is you pretty much need to be eating in a caloric surplus, which means you need to be eating more calories than you're burning. So basically, if you want to grow your bank account, you need to be gaining more money than you spend, right?
Mm-hmm.
If you want to put muscle, add pounds onto your body, you need to have more food than your body is spending. Then you have got the macronutrients. So you got protein. So protein is predominantly what muscle is made up of. There's also a lot of carbs in there too. But the general rule of thumb right now is 0.82 grams per pound of body weight. So if you're 200 pounds, you want to be getting about 164 grams of protein daily. And you probably want those for mostly like essential amino acid sources. So like meat, chicken, milk is great. And then I always throw some collagen or glycine in there for other benefits like anti-inflammatory and joint health and all that stuff.
Mm.
Then we've got carbs. So your muscles run on fat when they're at rest. But when you're lifting, they're going to run on carbs and their glycogen stores. So glycogen is just stored sugar. Mm-hmm. So you want to generally upregulate or increase your glycogen stores, your carb stores in your muscles as much as possible and your liver so you can recover as much as possible. So carbs are going to be very important. And they're also protein sparing, which means that if you eat a high carb diet compared to a low carb diet, you'll need to eat less protein to build muscle likely and to prevent muscle breakdown.
Mm-hmm. What are your thoughts if somebody's talking about being in like a nitrogen surplus?
As in like the nitrogen cycle?
Mm-hmm. So like a lot of people will say that you need to be like nitrogen positive to like you need to be eating enough protein to be like net positive whenever it comes to like having a certain amount of nitrogen.
And are you referring to like the nitrogen containing amino acids or just?
Mm-hmm.
I honestly have not really looked into that. That's an interesting point. What are your thoughts on it?
I think it makes sense from like an amino acid standpoint. Like you have to have a surplus of amino acids in order to have enough to spare. Mm-hmm. So to speak, to build excess tissue or to build more tissue on top of what's already present. But I don't necessarily think that the nitrogen surplus has much to do with it. I feel like a lot of times whenever you get too much protein in general, it's going to create ammonia, and then that ammonia is going to have a lot of side effects later on down the line.
Yeah, 100%. I don't think protein is something you want to overdo. It is, in one aspect, the least likely to be converted into fat. So like having a little bit of a high protein diet, probably not a bad idea, but eating 50% of your diet in protein, probably not a great idea either.
Right. Yeah. Plus you also get the protein farts.
Yeah, for sure. but I think probably the most important amino acid is probably leucine. Mm-hmm. That's at least it's what is currently believed to stimulate muscle protein synthesis. And interestingly, the one study I was looking at recently, they found that as long as leucine intake is matched, whatever the other amino acids aren't as big of a deal. Basically, they were looking at whey versus collagen protein. And as long as they had the same amount of leucine, it didn't matter. The muscle growth difference wasn't different. The question is, can you get that much leucine? Most people aren't just taking straight leucine.
Mm-hmm.
So it's hard to match that in a physiological, like real food basis versus in a lab. But I do think collagen and whey and casein all can play a good role in muscle building.
Mm-hmm. And you would... Would you say that there's an argument for not getting a large amount of your protein around your workouts, at least from collagen specifically, because it's not a complete protein?
Yeah, I wouldn't. I think glycine specifically as a pre-workout can help to prevent leaky gut a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
And having some protein or amino acids in your blood helps prevent protein breakdown in the workout as well, most likely. And then post-workout, I do think having some can have some anti-inflammatory benefits. But it's probably not where you want to get most of your protein. Around your workout is probably mostly from the essential amino acids. So food, collagen, whey, real food, meat, eggs. So yeah, you probably don't want to get most of your collagen. If you're going to do a protein shake with collagen, probably do it at night.
Okay.
Before you go to sleep.
Sounds good. Yeah. I really like the protein shake that you've been doing, like a mixture of casein and collagen together.
Yeah, I like that a lot. Because you got the milk is like 20% whey, 80% casein. So whey is more... breaks up fast, has digested fast. Casein is more longer lasting, which just means your amino acids in the blood is going to be higher for longer.
Mm-hmm.
So that should theoretically help to prevent muscle breakdown. And then you've got the collagen, which is also going to be anti-inflammatory. I think it also has, I think my theory is that it helps to decrease muscle protein breakdown, but there's not a lot of evidence on that. It's also really hard to measure muscle protein breakdown, but I just love the combination of all three. I think it's a potent combo.
Mm-hmm. So we have macronutrients. So we need all the macronutrients. Whenever it comes to fats, is there anything that you watch like around workouts for like digestibility and stuff like that?
Yeah. I mean, I probably don't recommend eating right before workout, depending on your digestion, probably like 2 hours before, maybe an hour. It depends on the person. And you probably don't want to have a huge meal either way. I think saturated fats are just the way to go. I don't really see any need. Maybe the monounsaturated fats can help with some gut health as well, the omega-9s. But generally, you want to be saturated fat, which is going to help increase cholesterol, increase testosterone, all of the cholesterol precursor steroid hormones.
Mm-hmm. So whenever it comes to, I guess, back to the protein question, is there like any merit to having protein before or after workout?
Yeah. So... generally having, like I said, having your amino acid stores high. So when you eat protein, it's broken down into its essential amino acids. and those sit in your blood for a while. When you have amino acids in, you always need some quantity of amino acids in your blood. So that's going to prevent your body. If you don't have enough amino acids in your blood, it's going to pull from your body's protein source, break that down. So having some amino acids in your bloodstream is just going to give your body that fuel source so it doesn't necessarily need to pull from its muscles.
Mm-hmm. So you would argue that pre-workout protein would be most beneficial?
Well, so post-workout is your best time. It's your most insulin-sensitive time. So basically you can eat the most and probably put on the most muscle in that period where you can go most anabolic. Mm-hmm. So they're both going to be very important. I would probably say your pre-workout meal is generally going to be less important, but it can help because the muscle is going to be, you're going to recover more post-workout, right? Mm-hmm. A lot of I think pre-workout is mostly focusing on minimizing recovery. So like how much stress you put on the workout, because if you're fasted, it's going to be more stressful than if you're fed. Mm-hmm. You have that glycogen stores and optimizing performance. Mm-hmm. So if you feel like crap and then you eat a couple Pop-Tarts and you feel even worse, probably not going to have a good lift.
Right. So you would say that overall protein intake is really where it's at versus like necessarily getting it in pre or post workout.
Yeah, overall protein. And then there is a couple of studies on basically muscle protein synthesis. So the thought process or the current belief is that you can only absorb and utilize like 50 grams of protein in a single serving. Mm-hmm. And after that, it's not like you don't use it or you just gets wasted, but it doesn't contribute to muscle protein synthesis. And this is also going to depend on the size of the individual. So how big someone is going to determine probably like someone that Ronnie Coleman, 250 plus pounds, probably going to get away with more protein versus someone that's 115 pounds, probably going to be less protein, but they also don't need as much protein. So spacing your protein throughout the day is probably relatively important compared to just slamming it all in one meal. Mm-hmm. And generally, from a thermodiet perspective, you want to have a protein, carb, and fat throughout the day at every meal anyway.
Mm-hmm. Very frequently. Yeah, for sure. So on top of the macronutrients, are there any specific types of micronutrients that you focus on or like electrolytes or anything like that?
Yeah, so electrolytes are very important. Sodium, potassium, calcium, all going to and magnesium. And chloride, technically, but they're all going to determine the electrical balance of the cell. So if you have, let's say, too much calcium or not enough sodium, potassium, that's when you get muscle cramps, right? Your cells basically can't turn off, your muscle cells can't contract properly. So that's going to be very important from both a performance perspective and also recovery. Magnesium is like the stress electrolyte. So anytime you're stressing your body, magnesium is going to be depleted pretty much. So getting enough magnesium is going to help with recovery, going to help with performance, anxiety, just a ton of benefits. And what was the other part you asked?
Like any specific micronutrients that you focus on?
So getting, obviously, anemia is a huge deal because it's how much blood and oxygen is being delivered to your cells. But copper regulates iron in the body. It's basically iron goes into your cells to drop off the oxygen. And then copper helps bring it back out, put it back into the bloodstream. So getting copper, and that's the protein ceruloplasmin, which does that, which is you need vitamin A as retinol, not beta carotene, to produce. So copper and retinol are extremely important. But then there's also zinc, which is going to be important for testosterone. Boron, which can help increase free T and lower SHBG. And there's a ton of like vitamin E helps to lower inflammation. Glycine, all that stuff. So there's a lot of micronutrients that they're all going to contribute in a small effect. But I think vitamin A is probably, I read an article called Vitamin A, the Lost Bodybuilding Nutrient. I think it's probably pretty important mm-hmm. for building muscle. And it's going to have a strong relationship with testosterone and the anabolic hormones as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, vitamin A is used inside of the mitochondria with cholesterol and thyroid hormone to help produce pregnenolone. So that's going to help produce more testosterone and hopefully some more muscle protein synthesis down the road as well.
Yeah, for sure, because it's the pregnenolone's precursor to all everything. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I also think probably vitamin D is pretty anabolic, but you need the vitamin A is also going to contribute to that, and magnesium is going to contribute to vitamin D levels. So, yeah, I think getting enough micronutrients probably from eating organ meats, at least on a weekly basis, is going to be very important for optimizing bodybuilding. It's also interesting because we see so many people today that are obviously on steroids or not, natural bodybuilders. And it would be interesting to see if we could dial in their nutrition and make sure they're getting enough retinol. How much more progress could they be getting? It's something I would like to see.
Yeah, kind of like reaping even more benefits from the potential PEDs that they could be
100%.
On?
100%. Or even naturals. I mean, you see Liver King, he claims to be a natural, just slamming his beef testicles and liver every night. Not that you need that much vitamin A, but I mean, you know, how big of a difference could this be making? I don't know.
Mm-hmm. So as far as like principles for nutrition, you would recommend eating frequently throughout the day?
Yeah, I think anywhere between 2 to 4 meals, depending on the person. Mm-hmm. I personally am doing like breakfast, dinner, and then a couple snacks in between. You don't necessarily need to be eating every 2 or 3 hours, small meals, but probably 3 meals, like breakfast, lunches, dinner, is probably good.
Mm-hmm. And then like if you're trying to build muscle, eating enough, is there a certain amount of calories over your maintenance that you recommend for that?
300 calories would probably be a good starting point. But again, it's like, what is your maintenance? I would say 300 calories is a good starting point. You don't want to gain too much fat. So the more you want to gain as much muscle as you can, and having that surplus come from, let's say, predominantly carbs and protein will help with maintaining your fat level. But I think 300 is a good starting point. And if you're getting too much fat, you can lower it. If you're not gaining enough weight, and your metabolism could also ramp up, up it up to mm-hmm. increase it.
And then for those of you listening, like an easy way to get your maintenance calories is just going to take your body weight in pounds and multiply that by about 15. If you're relatively sedentary throughout the day, so you're not that active, like you got a desk job or something like that, I'd probably recommend going like multiplying it by 14. And then if you're pretty active, you know, you could multiply it by 16 or even 17. You know, if you have like a construction job or something like that and you're using a jackhammer all day long, like you're going to burn a little bit more calories than the average person. So I'd recommend bumping that up a little bit.
100%. And if you're someone that gains weight easily, probably go closer to 13 or 14.
Mm-hmm.
I think everyone has a good idea probably on where their metabolic rate is compared to others, like whether or not they gain weight easily. But I think 15 is usually the gold standard as far as where to start.
Yeah, definitely. It'll at least get you in the ballpark to where it's not that hard to nudge it in either direction, depending on, you know, how fast you want to gain mm-hmm. weight or if you're gaining weight too quickly and stuff like that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and there's a ton of basal metabolic rate calculators online that you can use and then put your input in. Those are pretty accurate too. I mean, they're not that accurate, but they give you a ballpark idea.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I definitely don't like the MyFitnessPal calorie
recommendation. Is it too high?
I feel like it's either way too high or way too low. Depending on like the goal that you put in there.
Yeah, the N1 has me way too high. They had me like 4,000 calories, and I was like, damn.
Wow.
They also like to do like 200 grams of protein, which is kind of crazy to me. But
yeah, I don't think my girlfriend would like that at all because my protein farts would be very rank if that was the case.
Yeah, that's just like eating out of a Tupperware, which I don't want to do.
Yeah, no, not at all. So, get enough protein. Fill in the rest with carbohydrates and then a little bit of fat. Make sure that you get your electrolytes. Are there any other kind of like foundational principles whenever it comes to nutrition that you can think about?
I mean, as far as like meal frequency, you have a couple times a day eating, spreading it out. But other than that, I think that's pretty much covered.
Okay. What about supplementation?
So as far as supplementation, I mean, there's some cool studies. I mean, generally, let's like assume you're getting enough protein in. So if you need to get protein in, take a protein supplement. Casein or collagen are my favorite. Mm-hmm. Those will both help. But let's assume that you've got that matched. There are some interesting things. You're probably going to be looking at things that improve performance. Like we've got like Zoom here. So caffeine is very, very cool. It's also going to help increase insulin sensitivity, which will help you put on more muscle and allow more glycogen stores in your muscle to increase so you get more energy, more stored carbs in there. L-theanine is cool. So there's really two ideas behind supplementation for how I consider it. You want to minimize stress and you want to instant maximize recovery pretty much. And then you could also look at like T boosters potentially.
Mm-hmm.
So I like L-theanine and glycine pre-workout, which I talked about, because they help to decrease leaky gut. So during your workout, all the blood flow is going to your muscles and you have less going to your intestines. So what happens there is some bad bacteria, quote unquote, can leak through and it can cause inflammation. This is a pretty normal process. It's not a big deal. But if you're going for an intense workout and you can minimize it, it's just less stress that you have to recover from. And it's not only is it less stress that you have to recover from, it's stress that you don't need. So mm-hmm. muscle building is a quote unquote good stress because it'll help put on muscle. The endotoxin that's released or bad bacteria isn't helping you in any way.
Mm-hmm. Definitely. What about creatine supplementation?
Yeah, creatine is like the go-to supplement in the fitness industry right now. I just go for creatine monohydrate. Apparently, it can increase some DHT, which is interesting. It's going to have some anabolic and androgenic effects. But it's also it's a creatine when your cells start burning energy. So creatine monophosphate is like ATP. So it gives that phosphate group, and it's going to be the first energy source that your cells go to. So I think it's just going to help with performance generally. This current saying is like 5 milligrams a day or 5 grams a day, but that's also going to depend on your weight. I don't think heavier dudes are going to need more than lighter people. Mm-hmm. So 5 grams a day is like you can start with there if you want to increase it. But creatine is definitely going to help performance for sure.
Okay.
And brain performance too. They've done some studies on that, which is interesting.
Yeah, definitely. It's supposed to help with like short-term memory retention, I believe.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. Mm-hmm.
I think that's because it helps with the performance of the mitochondria. And so that's going to help kind of boost the performance of the mitochondria inside of the brain.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that makes sense. And then you can also look at things like lactic acid buffers. So basically when your cells aren't getting enough oxygen, they start to basically suffocate and they can't use glucose to turn it into ATP. So that what they start doing is they start bringing the lactic acid. Sometimes you want this lactic acid. So if you're doing a metabolic base where you're trying to get a pump, it's the lactic acid is what signals the muscle growth. So this is something where it's going to depend on your workout, what you're going for within strengths. But beta-alanine is a lactic acid buffer. Baking soda or magnesium, anything with bicarbonate salts is going to be a lactic acid buffer. And that can help to increase CO2 production. And then you could also look at things that optimize CO2 production, which is like methylene blue, niacinamide, B1, B2, which niacinamide is B3. Anything else you'd add?
Not that I can think of off the top of my head. For those people who have already optimized their diet and have already dialed in their recovery, and like you're probably looking for an extra 10%, you can usually do like a progesterone to DHEA mix from like a 3-to-1 ratio. 3-to-1 progesterone to DHEA. And that's going to have some really nice muscle building effects, mainly because of the way that it boosts recovery. So that's potentially something that you could do. I would recommend using a topical form of both of them. And, you know, if you're a relatively active person and you happen to have certain joints or things that are bothering you like that, I'd recommend just rubbing it there. It'll affect you systemically, but a lot of the times, like, it'll help with, like, a joint or something like that that's kind of tweaked. So that can be pretty beneficial. Pregnenolone can also be beneficial if you don't want to do that. Just get a, you know, a basic pregnenolone supplement. Around 300 milligrams a day is usually like a good starting place for it. And then there's some studies that show that you can go all the way up to a gram and, you know, still reap some of the benefits. And that it's also going to help with brain performance and stuff like that. That's all that I can think of off the top of my head with as far as like the more hormonal-based type of supplementation,
I'd say. I haven't really messed around with the hormonal-based supplementation, but pregnant or progesterone on a – I've used my mom's progesterone a couple times when I've had like a hurt joint, whatever, and that definitely heals it real quick.
Yeah, definitely, especially after jujitsu. Like if you tweak an elbow or a wrist or something like that, I'll just rub a little bit on there, and it's the next day it's almost 100% again.
And that's like another thing. If you are someone that's active outside of lifting, so basically lifting is like the intentional stress, right? Like we want to grow from that. Versus jiu-jitsu, it's more like a skill. We're not, unless you're trying to improve your conditioning, you probably don't want to be focusing on adapting to jiu-jitsu because it could interfere with your muscle growth processes, or it's just going to be more stress. So that's when things like beta-alanine, magnesium bicarbonate, or sodium bicarbonate, baking soda, L-theanine again, can help to just minimize the stress. And also, thing I didn't mention, I like to do mid-workout or intra-workout carbs. So I just drink juice. Lemonade is my favorite. It's light, tastes good. And that helps increase glucose oxidation. So basically, you're going to increase the amount of glucose you're using for fuel instead of burning more lactic acid or fat.
Mm-hmm. So whenever it comes to recovery, what are some of the pillars that you live by?
Sleep. So, and this is going to depend on the person, but getting enough 8 hours, 9 hours, 7 hours, whatever it is for you, getting enough sleep on a daily basis. Eating enough is probably the most important thing, and hitting all your micronutrients. So make sure you're slamming that liver once a week, and maybe like 5 to 10 oysters is going to really help. Probably not looking at your phone a couple hours before you go to bed and getting the blue light off, or wearing like red light glasses. But you could also look at red light therapy. Do you want to talk about that at all?
Red light therapy? Yeah, I mean, most of the benefits that I've seen from red light therapy is just the ability to turn off the sympathetic nervous system and go into the parasympathetic nervous system. Mm-hmm. Especially in the evenings, like getting rid of the blue light and just turning on the red light, reading a book with the red light on. Like, I'll fall asleep very quickly and sleep throughout the entire night with just doing that alone. Especially if I have my ice cream before, like, it's a good recipe for good sleep for sure.
Pre-sleep ice cream is mandatory.
Yeah.
And breakfast ice cream.
Yeah. There's an argument for having ice cream for breakfast and dinner for sure.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. But you're just getting enough calcium in. And I mean, the fat, most of recovery is probably nutrition based. And honestly, you also have the stress side, just like making sure you're not too stressed at work, whatever that entails, but making sure you're just trying to live. Ideally, if you're going to maximize your bodybuilding, you pretty much are going to sit in your ass and not do much outside of the rest of the day. Not that you're not going to stimulate yourself mentally, but you don't want to be going to a hardworking job where you're like physical or you're very stressed on a daily basis. You want to kind of have a relaxed lifestyle outside of bodybuilding.
Mm-hmm. Ideally, like the way that I look at it is kind of looking at your overall stress load. So like looking at all the physiological stress that you have and looking at all the psychological stress that you have and kind of, I mean, even if you got to write down a list and then look at the areas of that you can eliminate. So mm-hmm. like, you know, if you're going on a hard bike ride on your way to work or something like that, like replace that with a car ride and that eliminates a lot of the stress right there. Or like if there's a relationship that is kind of like eating away at you and taking all of your energy, maybe look at getting rid of that relationship or seeing how you can patch it up and kind of get rid of that psychological stressor. So that's what I would recommend, is looking at that overall stress load and seeing like the places where you can kind of eliminate stress as much as possible, which, I mean, I feel like that's good in general to do, but especially if you're looking to optimize muscle building, like cortisol is going to be the enemy pretty much, mm-hmm. Outside of triggering certain hormetic responses inside of the body. So, eliminating that as much as possible is definitely going to be beneficial. I'd say going on a daily walk is going to be beneficial because like it doesn't tax the nervous system at all. So it's not going to interfere with your physiological recovery. And it's very psychologically beneficial as well. Mm-hmm. It's also going to help with digestion, which is going to help with, you know, just about everything. And then also getting sunlight is going to have very beneficial effects in terms of lowering the amount of stress hormones in the body, upregulating protective hormones and stuff like that.
Yeah, having some kind of movement practice outside of lifting is probably going to be very beneficial. And I also think, as you said, like we have to look at lifting is like your body doesn't know if the stress is different from your relationship stress, right? So we want to minimize weightlifting is a good stress because we want it, right? Mm-hmm. It's not like your body sees it as a good stress. It's just another thing that it has to take care of, adapt to, whatever that means. So the more things we can eliminate, as you said, outside of the quote unquote good stress, just the more we'll be able to recover, and hopefully the more we'll be able to do in the gym, more gains we'll be able to do.
Speaking of, what is your frequency? What kind of frequency do you recommend for like lifting frequency whenever it comes to like the amount that you can lift and still being able to recover from it?
So if you're someone that doesn't want to spend their whole life in the gym, 3 days is probably the go-to. You might be able to get away with two if you're closer to beginner or going really hard in these lifts, but it gets hard to do all the muscles in 2 days. I like 4 days. I think that's the sweet spot personally, where you can really program it out. You can look at 5 days and where you're lowering volume, you're doing less per day. And you can even look at 6 days, but at some point it's just a very marginal increase in benefit, if there is any. And again, it's going to depend on how much you're recovering from. I think 4 days is a sweet spot because you can do basically quarter body split. You can do a half body split. And again, this is going to depend on what you're going for. But if you could do 4 to 5 exercises in a lift, maybe 6, or and then dividing the muscle groups up between them, you can very easily accomplish everything in 4 days.
Mm-hmm. Definitely. Yeah, I would say some of the times that I've been the strongest in my life and felt probably like the biggest from a muscular perspective was whenever I was working out 4 days a week for sure. Mm-hmm. I don't know what it is. It just 4 days a week seems to be a really good number.
Yeah, I agree. And it's nice having the weekend and the day in between. But you also have to consider things like, so if you're a power lifter, it is probably beneficial for you to lift 6 days a week. Not that you have to go very intense, because the more times you can practice the skill of benching, squatting, deadlifting, it's a skill, right? It's something that you probably need to do every day. You don't need to necessarily kill yourself and go do 9 RP every day, but practicing the form, like anything else, like guitar, like anything else, is a skill. It is, obviously, it's very taxing on the body, so you have to be careful with it. But when you're going for something that's purely a hormonal and like physical response, recovery in bodybuilding, recovery is the name of the game. In athleticism and powerlifting, things like that, a lot of times putting the most stress in your body that you can handle is the name of the game, basically the most practice you can handle. And that's not generally good for health. Mm-hmm. So it's just two kind of different goals.
Yeah. I mean, would you say that is because of you basically have to be a technician whenever you're in those type of situations?
Yeah. I mean, it's just like, it's just repetition, repetition, repetition versus bodybuilding. It's not, more is not better.
Mm-hmm. Makes sense. Let's see. We had a list here. Let's see what else we got here to talk about on this hair topic. Honestly, it looks like we covered everything.
Yeah. Should we talk about biomechanics at all? Or?
Yeah, sure.
So generally when you're going for weightlifting, tension is the name of the game. So basically how much force is intramuscular tension, how much force a given muscle is producing, which is why those compound lifts tend to not be ideal, because it's distributing the tension across more muscle groups versus if you can just isolate one muscle group. So if instead of doing, let's say, I can do a dumbbell bench press and set it up to be mostly chest, maybe not do the whole range of motion to make it like pretty much like, let's say, 90% chest, 80% chest. Now I can attribute more volume to my delts and I can go to the delt press and my delts aren't taxed from that chest press.
Mm-hmm.
So I can distribute it more evenly and then I can make more gains because I'm making sure that these are the isolated factor.
Mm-hmm.
And tension, and there are other drivers of muscle growth and a lot of things that potentiate further muscle growth. So like when you're doing a pump split where it's like high reps, shortened position of muscle group where it's like maximally flexed.
What's the difference between like a shortened position and a lengthened position?
So when you flex your bicep or any muscle, it's like quad is in a leg extension, that's going to be when the muscles are closest together.
Mm-hmm. Like the insertion and origin point?
Yes, exactly.
Can you explain what those two things are?
Yeah, so if you think of a muscle like a rope, they attach from one end to the other on a bone, right? And basically when it's fully stretched, so when you stretch your quad, that's going to be the two bones are furthest apart. When you flex your quad, that's when the two bones are close together. All muscles do are pull on that rope. So they pull from insertion to origin. So when you squeeze your muscle, you're just pulling on that rope, getting it closer together, which is why we think of the easier way to think about it is like your bicep runs from your shoulder joint, attaches to your forearm, right? It doesn't attach to the same bone. So you can see it literally when you flex your bicep, you're pulling your forearm closer to your shoulder. Now, if you do that from behind your body, that's going to be a lengthened position bicep curl. Versus if you keep flexing it and pull it up towards your face, it's going to be a shortened position bicep curl.
Mm-hmm.
And so within those positions, certain things are more biased, right? So in the shortened position, basically like the bustle runs out of space. And so it's very metabolically costly to exercise in that position. So you have to use a lot more energy.
Mm-hmm.
Versus in the lengthened position and the mid-range, you're much better at producing force because there's a lot of space for this muscle to contract because the muscle fibers are a lot further apart.
Mm-hmm.
So that you're much better at producing force in these areas. And that's when you can look at, that's why like a bench press is a great exercise. Generally, lengthened position exercises are going to be better for accumulating tension because you're stronger in those positions. But it doesn't mean that you should neglect the shortened positions. And there are times when the shortened positions are better depending on what you're going for.
Mm-hmm. So like, whenever you do like a bench press, for instance, like what part of that is actually the lengthened position and the shortened position?
So it's also going to depend on where that muscle, the exercise overloads, right? Mm-hmm. So with free weights, dumbbells, it's always going to be hardest when the load is furthest away from the joint. So it's basically always going to be 9 degrees.
Mm-hmm.
So that's going to be not the very bottom of the bench press, but like a couple degrees up. That's going to be the lengthened position of the back. So they can't really extend much further behind your body. So that's going to be a lengthened, overloaded exercise. Versus like a pec fly, it's going to be when your arms come across your body, and depending on how you do it with a cable, it's going to be a shortened position overload because it's overloaded in this portion when your pec is the arm is closer across the center line. Versus a dumbbell is going to be another lengthened overload
because
it's hardest at the bottom.
Mm-hmm. Hmm. So like, when is there an argument to work the full range of motion, and then when is there an argument to work a partial range of motion?
So. Well, full range of motion is obviously like relative to the muscle, right? So like at the top of a bench press, it's mostly going to be delts because you're not really pulling your arm across your body anymore.
Mm-hmm.
So let's consider like full range for like a given exercise and a given muscle. Because like, so when you do the entire range of motion bench press, you're switching to the delts. So you're not really getting much more chest at that point, right? Mm-hmm. If we consider that the main driver of muscle growth is mechanical tension, then pretty much you want to take the muscle through its entire range of motion with a lot of tension on it. If you can do, you're never going to be able to do that in one exercise for the most part. But so that's when you can get multiple exercises that overload different positions. So like, you can look at like an incline bicep curl and then a high bicep curl or a spider curl. And that's two exercises. You're overloading in short position, you're overloading in length of position. For muscle growth, that's generally going to be the best.
Sounds good.
Cool.
Is that pretty much it?
Yeah.
Is that all the biomechanic knowledge that you feel like laying on us today?
Yeah, I think we can go in depth on a later date, but I feel like this is a good start for right now.
Yeah, definitely. Would you say, actually, one thing that I kind of wanted to talk about a little bit was like breathing. Whenever it comes to lifting, like how important is breathing?
Breathing is really important when you're lifting. So an interesting thing to think about is when you breathe in, right, your rib cage literally expands. You actually get taller. You can see someone when they expand, it's like a half inch, nothing serious. But when you exhale, you get shorter. Mm. So another way to look at movement is there's internal rotation and external rotation, or compression and expansion. So breath in would be expansion. Breath out, breathing out would be compression. You probably want to be breathing out or most compressed at the bottom of a lift, right? So you think about a squat. When people fail in a squat, a lot of times it's because they're failing to maintain their pressure, right? So they lose the squat. It's because your body's like a soda can, right? If you, that's why the people are braced. They get trapped that air in. If they lose that oxygen and they lose the gas inside them, then all of a sudden that's, you can, all of a sudden your back starts to move, things start to fall apart. So generally in the position, like the hardest position, so the bottom of a deadlift where you're most compressed, compression is like force production. Mm-hmm. Squat, the bottom of a squat is you want to be breathed out, and then you can breathe in at the point as you're expanding, as you're coming up. But also making sure you're getting enough oxygen between reps in the set. Generally for tension-based training, you pretty much want as much time between sets as possible. Obviously, no one wants to take 20 minutes between sets. But anyhow, your recovery is, your recoverability, 90 seconds to 3 minutes, probably good.
Mm-hmm. So you're thinking more like powerlifting type of movements?
Yeah, it is important in like bicep curls and stuff like that, but it's less important because there's just a lot less going on.
Okay.
It's like, because your rib cage really isn't challenged in a bicep curl, right? Mm-hmm. Versus in a squat, deadlift, even a bench press, you have to maintain enough pressure in there to really be able to produce enough force. Because mm-hmm. it's like, what's the old saying is like, try and shoot a cannonball off of a canoe, right? Mm-hmm. There's nothing to push off of. So bracing and taking that breath in is just trying to trap that oxygen in your body to make you like a soda can. So if the soda can's open, you open that cap, now it can't produce as much force, right? You can try and step on a soda can with it closed. It's impossible. You open the cap, you release that pressure. It's easy to snack, easy mm-hmm. to break down. So it's going to be much more important in the bigger lifts where it's heavier, but it also is going to be important in things like rows, isolation exercises, probably more important there as a means of like getting oxygen into your body mm-hmm. and CO2, but less important from a pressure perspective. And also I think probably, it's really hard, easier said than done, but nasal breathing is probably going to be optimal just to prevent releasing too much CO2, offloading too much CO2.
Mm-hmm. Sounds good. Sweet.
Cool.
That's all the questions I got.
Awesome.
You want to talk a little bit about this awesome supplement in front of us?
Yeah, so today's episode, again, is brought to you by Zoom Pre-Workout, and it's a pretty dope pre-workout. It's going to have some sugar, so sugar is going to help your body use sugar and keep it from breaking down protein and also help to optimize performance. It's going to have L-theanine, which is we were talking about before. It's going to help prevent leaky gut, and it's going to have a couple ingredients in there that are going to help to increase blood flow. And glucose oxidation, so that's going to be the B vitamins in there, which is biotin and is it B2? Is it
we got some B1, we got some biotin, that looks like all the B vitamins we got in here.
And then we have the, what is it, nitrosogen?
Let's see here, we have calcium, we got chloride, sodium, potassium, so we got the electrolytes that we need for good action potentials to take place to allow for a nice muscle pump to happen. L-citrulline.
It's going
to
help with the pump.
Mm-hmm. Natural caffeine.
There we go.
L-theanine. Astragalus membanaceus, which is just Panax ginseng.
Which is a dopamine booster as well, right?
Yeah, actually, estrogen. Mm-hmm.
So that's going to help with recovery and probably muscle contraction as well.
Mm-hmm. Just make you feel good while you're working out too.
Yes, sir. Mm-hmm. Awesome.
Sweet. Well, everybody that's still here, thanks for listening. I appreciate y'all. And we'll talk to y'all next time.
Have a good one.